So one of the biggest hot button issues right now is cryptocurrencies and taxes. A lot of people have a ton of questions out there. And what makes this interview a little bit different is that I not only go by the Liberty Advisor, but I also go by the Crypto Wealth Advisor as well. So these questions are questions that a lot of them I already know the answer to, but I asked questions that I thought would be relevant from the perspective of somebody who is a certified financial planner and also as somebody that is trailblazing in the crypto space as well. So I know that you will find today's show to be incredibly valuable. If you have questions you'd like us to answer that we didn't answer, feel free to shoot us an email at info@thelibertyadvisor.com, and we will try to discuss that on a later podcast. And also, before we get going, this is for informational purposes only. Yes, I am a financial advisor, but unless you're paying me for one-on-one advice and unless I know everything that's going on in your life as well as goals, I'm not in a position to give out advice. But with that said, let's get into the podcast. Today, we are joined by Beth Logan, who is an enrolled agent with Coslog Tax Advisors. Beth is one of the few tax professionals who has an understanding of crypto, and more importantly, what that means for you and your taxes. The government has basically done a great job of making this very difficult for people to understand what the heck's going on. The IRS says Bitcoin's property, you know, but they say other ones necessarily aren't property. The CFT says that it's a commodity. The SEC says the ICOs are more than likely securities, but that Bitcoin and Ethereum aren't. And basically, this has a lot of people scratching their heads and wondering what the heck's going on. And we're hoping that Beth can help us out with this and a lot more questions that we have today. But I think really the first thing people are probably wanting to know is probably what the difference between an enrolled agent is and maybe a CPA or certified public accountant. Because a lot of people probably heard the terminology CPA before, but they might not know what an enrolled agent is. And so if you could just give us a little bit about maybe of your background and also what an enrolled agent is, as opposed to maybe a CPA that people are familiar with.
Well, a certified public accountant is certified at the state level, and they can do a variety of things, including tax preparation, representation before the IRS for a tax preparer, and auditing. Some CPAs do nothing but corporate auditing, corporate books, things like that, and they never touch taxes. An enrolled agent is a federally licensed tax professional. So we are licensed through the U.S. Treasury Department, and as I tell people, we're like the old Kentucky Fried Chicken ad. We do one thing and we do it well, and that's taxes. So that's really our focus. It's not that we don't do accounting if we're looking at people's books to understand how to prepare their tax return. It's just that's our focus, and we don't do any auditing.
So is that old saying that goes, you know, it's, you know, maybe a CPA is, and a lot of my family are CPAs, and so I mean, it's not like I've got anything against them, but, you know, they're sort of like a mile wide and an inch deep. We've heard that saying before, whereas an enrolled agent seems like you guys are there just for taxes and none of the other stuff that goes along with, you know, the CPAs you need to learn. So they've got more of like a breadth, wider breadth of what they need to know.
Correct. That's an excellent way to put it.
Okay. Well, I've stolen it from other people, so I didn't come up with it. So I just take the best and steal it. And is there anything else about your bio that you want to maybe get into? Or I know that we had talked once before and you'd mentioned that you'd done some different speaking at like MIT and different public libraries, and maybe just want to give us a little bit of background of what or how you got into the space and really what intrigues you about this space.
Well, I actually have an engineering and computer background, and this all started with cryptocurrency because we were talking, a bunch of enrolled agents were talking about the new things that are happening in the tax world, and at the time it was marijuana, cryptocurrencies, things like that. And one of them had said, well, could you research it and explain some of it to us? So I ended up doing a presentation that I called, you know, The Changing Times and Their Tax Implications. And in the process, I went to the MIT Bitcoin conference and started talking to people. And with the computer and engineering background, it was comfortable to me. None of the information they gave me made me nervous or confused. So that kind of helped. And then I just kind of merged that understanding of the computer and programming world with the understanding of the tax world, and then began explaining it to other tax professionals. But I do have some other, tax areas I specialize in. So I wrote a book called Divorce and Taxes After Tax Reform. And I also have a few, you know, other areas within taxes that I do specialize. But Bitcoin is one that, like I said, a lot of people seem to be nervous about, but because of the engineering, I was very comfortable with.
And it seems like we've got divorces going on too in the crypto markets with different hard forks, and maybe that could be a segue into how that's taxed. I believe that when Bitcoin Cash broke off from Bitcoin, that wasn't a taxable event. It'd only be if you sold your Bitcoin Cash for Bitcoin Core, then that would be a taxable event. That would be my understanding.
Correct, but it could have been a taxable event if you were intentionally trying to earn Bitcoin Cash. So there are ways that some people may have needed to claim the receipt of the Bitcoin Cash as income, but for most investors, it was as if a stock split into two companies, and then they had shares for both companies, and it was just when you sell it, then you have to determine the basis, which is a little more complicated than just if you buy it, because then the basis is very clear.
Yeah, and I could see that being an absolute mess. And maybe let's just get into some of the different ways that cryptocurrency is taxed, because there's all sorts of different ways it's taxed. I mean, for a lot of people, they're probably familiar with, you know, short-term and long-term capital gains. And maybe you can sort of get into, and maybe this is a question I already know the answer to, but a lot of people might not know, hey, what's the difference between short-term and long-term capital gains? And then, why would I want to have maybe long-term gains as opposed to short-term gains?
Well, long-term gains are 1 year and 1 day the asset has been held. That's very important that I said 1 year and 1 day and not 366 days, because in a leap year, it's 367 days. So if it's February 1st, it better be February 2nd the next year, no matter leap year or not. So if you've held it that long, then you get the tax on the gains is at a reduced rate. So there's a separate tax rate for long-term capital gains and qualified dividends. Short-term capital gains have the same tax rate as income and wages, things like that, which is a higher tax rate. So I highly encourage most people to keep it long-term. And in the state of Massachusetts, long-term gains are 5.1% and short-term are 12%. So in this state, it's even worse if you do short-term gains. Now, given the choice between having gains that are taxable and having the value of your asset crash and having a loss, go ahead and take the gains and pay the short-term rate for tax. But if you can wait 1 year and 1 day, that's usually better for people. And that is true of whether it's stock or cryptocurrencies or other what we call capital assets, property that can be held for a long term.
And if you are worried about, you've got millions of dollars of gains and, next time crypto runs up and you think it's going to dump again and you're worried about, short term, long term, talk to me about the different trust strategies. So to give us a quick shameless plug over there. But, also it gets into, and actually some people could even have a 0% capital gain rate if they, depending on what their income is. So a lot of people might be worried about, hey, should I declare or not declare? And then, it could be, hey, you could declare everything and you actually might have a 0% tax rate depending on, how much you're actually selling and then also what your income is. Is that true?
Yes, not only is that true, but I have clients who they do it even with stock. So anytime that they're in a low income situation, whether maybe they were laid off or in between, that when they retire and when they start taking Social Security, they might be at a point where they have low income. And that's when I encourage them to do all sorts of things, especially if it's long-term capital gain, because it's 0% interest. And that's as long as they used to be that the capital gains tax brackets were the same as the income tax brackets. The brackets were the same, the rates were different, but with the recent tax reform, that's changed. So they're close, but not quite the same. But usually if you're in the 10 or 12% tax bracket, your capital gains are 0%.
Yeah, it's also important to note that the current tax reform wasn't really a tax simplification. It was just, if anything, more of a case to have people like yourself to help people out.
Yeah, it's crazy mess. It is not simplified. Even though we're now on a quote-unquote postcard, It's much more complicated with 6 new schedules and 1,000 new pages of tax code.
Yeah, but they can get a nice little sound bite, when, I guess, when they're doing their campaigning. But anyways, I guess shifting gears here, we also have some, you know, if you were, let's say, mining, you know, back, you know, on your laptop back in 2010, and, you know, you're still, you know, a hodler, you know, how would those gains be classified? Would those be actually income gains because you were mining, or does it depend if you're mining as a hobby versus mining as a business? And can you get into that a little bit?
Well, the IRS was pretty explicit about mining, which is interesting because all they gave is a 6-page question and answer. And normally when there's something new, they give regulations, which can go on for hundreds of pages. But when it comes to cryptocurrency, they only gave us 6 pages. But one of the questions was mining. And that is considered income. And it's considered income at the value the day you receive it. So if you mine, if you're doing mining and you receive 1 Bitcoin and on that day it's worth $1,500, you have received $1,500 worth of income. And if by the end of the year it's only worth $1,000, you still have to declare $1,500 worth of income. And then when you sell it, you can possibly declare the loss. But it is one of the few things they were pretty explicit about.
And that was one thing that I wasn't, until right now, I wasn't really sure. I knew it was classified as income, but I wasn't sure if it's classified as income from when you took receipts of it or when you actually sold it. And it sounds like, you know, there's a lot of people out there who may have been mining it at 19,000 and now they can only sell for 3 and they've got a huge tax problem on their hand. Potentially it could be, you know, enormous tax problems depending on, and that wasn't even something that was really on my radar until basically you had just mentioned it a few seconds ago. So I made a little, my audio recorder made a little mark on there, like, okay, let's go back to this point later on when we review this, because I know this could be very valuable information for a lot of people that are out there and confused about what this means for their taxes.
Well, the same thing actually happens when employees receive stock. Usually they receive stock options, but they could receive stock as part of their wages and then later on go to sell it and it could be at a loss. Well, they've had to claim it as income. So it's actually very analogous to that. But unfortunately, that's the way it's set up.
Yeah, and I can see this causing absolute nightmares for a lot of people out there. And I know another big question that's really out there is you've got somebody, let's say they turn their, you know, $5,000 of Bitcoin into $500,000 and they change their Bitcoin, let's say, into Ethereum, and now they grew their $500,000 into maybe, you know, maybe $50,000. And so they took, you know, $5,000, it was $500,000, then they didn't pay the taxes on it, and they changed it to Ethereum, and now they don't even, now they might not even have the money to even pay the taxes because they don't have enough money left. And we've seen, you know, some different stories on MarketWatch and some other publications where it did detail these types of stories. And so, I mean, this definitely highlights the importance of, I guess, needing to pay your taxes when it's due. But can you kind of get into, you know, the taxation of when you swap between, let's say, Bitcoin and Ethereum, and, you know, is that a taxable event? Or what if you swap between, you know, basically what's your kind of stance on when people exchange one for another? And I know there was some guidance in January of this year saying it was not a like-kind exchange, but has it ever, like if someone made the change in 2017 or 2016, would that be a like-kind exchange, or can you provide any clarity on that?
It has been generally accepted that there is no like-kind exchange. Here again, IRS only gave us a 6-page Q&A. So they actually don't address it. But the general feeling is that it's not a like-kind exchange. And this comes from 2 views of looking at it. The first one is for stock. If you sell, you know, GE stock for Apple stock, nobody thinks that's the like-kind. They think that they're different. So we tend not to consider like-kind exchange for this. And there's another reason, and this actually came up when I was at the MIT Bitcoin conference, is I asked people, do you think anybody who is, you know, in the cryptocurrency world views Bitcoin and Ethereum as similar? And they're like, no, they're not similar. I mean, those two are, you know, 2 of the biggest, but they actually have a lot of differences to them. So to talk about like-kind exchange is a little difficult when the people using the cryptocurrency don't think things are similar, and the IRS has never ruled on it, but the general feeling is that it isn't. And that's where practitioners that I've spoken to and the way I handle it. Again, with only 6-page Q&A, your other option is to take it to tax court and argue out your side, but I don't actually recommend that for most people. The trick with what's happened, and this is true if you think of stock as well, if I bought Apple in 2005 before the iPhone came out and then sold it in 2015, I would have had a huge gain. Then the trick is, what if I turned around and bought GE in 2015 and now it's gone down? Now I have a loss. You need to pay the taxes when you have the gain. But what I usually tell people is you need to take some of that cash out to pay the taxes. And people with cryptocurrencies need to be doing the same thing. What happens if they don't? Well, it's you know, the same as any other taxpayer who doesn't pay their taxes, unfortunately. You end up in trouble with the IRS and owing, and then you may have to do a payment plan or maybe be currently uncollectible until something happens to your cryptocurrency. But if you're currently non-collectible, the IRS usually has a lien on your assets. And I think if they saw you in the cryptocurrency area, because there's no real way to put a lien on those assets, you might get a little more pushback to be currently non-collectible, and they probably try and dig into it. Do keep in mind that the IRS has spent over $2 million this year alone in blockchain analysis to find out who has what cryptocurrency where. They're not looking for somebody, you know, they're not going to spend a lot of time looking for somebody who has 0.001 Bitcoin and they traded in half of it.
They're not coming after me then. Good.
Yeah, they're looking for people with money.
Yeah, and that is one thing, you know, because I kind of come from the more hardcore libertarian stance. A lot of people are like, you know, why are you even talking to a tax professional? Because, you know, there's a lot of people out there who want to play by the book and they want to play by the rules and they want to make sure they're not going to end up in a cage. And maybe the government, IRS, spent $2 million this year, but it's come out that the NSA has actually been tracking this. And I believe it was back to 2011, and there was other papers where, like, pretty much what predated even Satoshi's white paper was in 1996. The NSA had a paper out about, you know, electronic cash that was pretty much like the predecessor to the Satoshi white paper. So it sort of leads me to believe that they've been tracking this certainly for quite some time. And I guess, you know, kind of keeping with this this theme of like-kind exchanges, well, you know, where it gets a little bit more tricky is, you know, let's say you've got these, you know, ERC tokens, or, you know, which, in, you know, for people out there wondering what that might mean, is a lot of times when, instead of creating their own brand new chain, what companies were doing is they're creating these ICOs, or they're just creating these tokens, and then the tokens usually were on the Ethereum platform, so people could trade Ethereum for then, you know, a token on the Ethereum blockchain. And then it's like, well, you know, was I really selling the asset, or was I, you know, swapping from basically, you know, the mainnet to a token of that coin? So if you were to, let's say, I guess skipping to the end here, if you were to say you have Ethereum and you change it for, you know, Binance coin, and not making any recommendations, just throwing out a hypothetical there, you know, would that be a taxable event? And that's such a kind of a weird area that I'm not sure if that anything like that's ever existed in the tax realm before, because I don't know if we've ever had one asset that can be exchanged into a subset of the same asset. It just seems like a very weird thing to conceptualize.
Well, at this time, my recommendation is that people treat it as a sale of the Ethereum to cash, and then a cash purchase of the tokens. Assuming that you've had to use your Ethereum or other cryptocurrency to buy it, so then it would be an asset sale. Basically, you could also think of it as a barter, right? You could give services or product for services or product. It's still a taxable event. So if you came into my office to have your taxes done and said, hey, Beth, I'll do your landscaping for a month for free, I would still have to claim that as income. And you, as if you had an actual landscaping business, would have to claim it as income. And so it's still a taxable event when you barter. And that's really what this is. There is a catch there, though, that some of those tokens with airdrops, people are getting without spending any of their cryptocurrency. That's a different discussion, because now you haven't bartered or spent money to get that token. It was just kind of given to you. So then you got to think of that more as what happens if you have a stock where the company splits into two companies, now you have shares of both. And do you make one of them a basis of zero and the other one have all the basis? Or when it splits, do you divide the basis between those two? The other thing is, were you actually out kind of soliciting for these tokens? Then maybe it was a hobby or income. But in general, that's how I look at it. And it's a difficult thing, because at any point the IRS may come out with hundreds of pages of regulations and tell us all that the way we've been handling it isn't quite right. But this is reasonable, and given the information they have, it can be supported. And that's one of the important things to do when there's any questions in the tax law.
Yeah, and first off, the first thing I'm thinking right now is, if I'm doing any landscaping in December in Massachusetts, it's a code word for shoveling, and I better have a pretty big tax problem if I'm going to be shoveling for a month in Massachusetts, or a pretty small sidewalk or something up there. But I guess the airdrops is something I didn't even really think of. So you're saying people can choose if they want to, you know, split the, you know, so say you've got, you know, it's $100 token, then there's an airdrop. You could say, okay, well, the airdrop now has a cost basis of, you know, zero, and any gain upon there, it's appreciated, and the other asset as $100, or can you split it like 50-50, or and then all of a sudden now the airdrop is, you know, is underwater. I mean, so how does that work? I hadn't even thought of that before we, because it was sort of like last second coming up with these questions, and, you know, decided, and that was one of them, I guess, that slipped by me, was how to treat airdrops.
Well, again, 6-page Q&A, and it's not in there. So you have to base it on things that we normally do in the tax world. And like I said, if you have a stock that splits into two companies, you either give it zero basis or you split it. And so that is something that you can say, okay, we're following this part of the tax code in handling cryptocurrency, and you can make a rational explanation. The trick, though, is that you have to be consistent. So if you get 5 airdrops, you can't treat 3 of them one way and 2 of them another. Whatever you do, you be consistent, and it doesn't, you know, across your whole investment portfolio of cryptocurrency. And I don't think you should split them 50-50. A good example is let's say you have one coin that's worth $1,000, and you get a token that's worth $100. Well, the total together are worth $1,100. So maybe I should use 900 and 100, because yeah, now you have a total of 1,000. So maybe you split it 10%, 90% for cost, or you leave 100% on the original one that you had. But you would never then turn around and split it 50-50 and try and sell the low price one for a loss, because that's not a rational basis for that one. And it would not be one that you could really support if you were ever questioned. But 90%, 10% you could support, because it came from the value of the coins at the time of the airdrop. A zero on the airdrop could also be supported, because you really didn't pay for it, so it has no value. So there's things like that that we take, like I said, from other places in the tax code and try and apply them so that we have a good foot to stand on if the IRS asks any questions.
Yeah, and we'll probably wait to get an airdrop like April 14th from the IRS. Be like, oh, here you go. Here's some more information right before, you know, as everyone is scrambling here to do their taxes. And, you know, as we're coming up to, you know, year end, and probably coming up to, you know, kind of closing this out, we got a few more questions here. You know, do you, you know, in terms of wash sale rules and what that means for, you know, the listener out there is in stock trading, if I sell, you know, Apple stock at a loss right now, maybe I bought it 2 months ago, it's a loss right now, and I want to then buy it back, I've got to traditionally wait 30 days, or I forget, it's 31 days to be safe. otherwise it's deemed to be a wash sale, and then it cancels out and you don't get the benefits of doing that. However, that applies to securities. And since Bitcoin and Ethereum in particular, those are the two that there's been some sort of guidance on, those have been grandfathered into, property or not securities. And it almost seems like you could, let's say you bought Bitcoin at, 19,000, and then you sold it today, you could take the loss, and it almost seems like you just buy that right back in immediately. And then now you'd have a new basis to then be able to deduct gains from in the future, sort of my understanding from that, which is, initially when I first started thinking about this, I'm like, oh yeah, wash sale rules, let's wait 31 days. And I was like, wait a minute, it's not a security. So those rules only apply to securities. So, am I sort of on the right track there, or what sort of are we to make of that?
Right, the wash rules only apply to securities, so therefore you do have the ability at this time to sell it at a loss and then buy it right back, claim the loss for the tax year, and then start off the next year with the same assets but a different basis. And that is as of today. Again, the IRS could come out later and say, here's the regulations, and we are claiming a wash rule for it. But right now, if you read the wash rules, they do say security only, and everybody's taking that approach.
And it almost seems like with some of these other tokens that since they haven't been deemed property or necessarily securities, it almost would seem if you bought into an ICO and were trying to do that, then that'd be more of like a gray area because those would be securities. So, I mean, not that I'm giving any recommendations or you're giving recommendations right now, but it almost seems like you're buying an ICO that, and you're selling at a big loss, which, odds are that that's going to be the case, then you probably would want to wait the 31 days just to be safe on like an ICO. But when it comes to Bitcoin and Ethereum, it seems like those are the only two there's, enough guidance to, prove otherwise.
Well, it's tricky because every day people are creating more and more different
usually crap.
Know whether coins, tokens, airdrops, every day something new is coming out of the cryptocurrency world. And I think at this time, to be safe, you would wait the 31 days. Although if you read the Q&A from the IRS, they don't say Bitcoin or Ethereum, they say virtual currency. Of course, they turn around and say virtual currency is property. So anything that falls under that, of course, there's no clear definition of virtual currency. So we're in this limbo land. But I believe in, you're better off safe than sorry. Now, there are times that I'm a big believer in ask forgiveness instead of permission. But when it comes to the IRS, I'm more of a better safe than sorry person. And so waiting the 31 days is probably a good idea, but at this time there's nothing written that you can't sell it. And keep in mind here though, there's still a lot of, you mentioned this at the beginning, that it's treated differently everywhere. Even within the US Treasury Department, the IRS treats cryptocurrency as property. FinCEN says if you move more than $10,000 worth, it has to be log someplace because of the Bank Secrecy Act. So they treat it like cash in part of FinCEN. So you have a conflict even within the Treasury Department. Then, as you said, there's the SEC and there's other government organizations that all treat it differently. Ohio now accepts it for tax payments. So to them, it's more like cash. So with all this confusion, I guess, or different perspectives, I think it won't be too long before finally the government says, okay, we have to come up with something. But right now we are in kind of a limbo state. And so better safe than sorry is probably good because Congress does make laws that are retroactive.
Yeah. And the congressmen, don't even know how like email or the basic internet works, or, they're up there saying, accusing Google CEO of making their iPhone not work. They're like, well, you realize, iPhone isn't made by Google. And, and like, this is like the stupidest stuff that's like, the people that have asked these questions, and like in back in the day, I think you had like John McCain, regulating different, you know, internet, like email protocols, and he didn't even have email. And so, you know, it's people that know nothing about this are trying to regulate, and it's usually however they can get you the hardest is probably how they're going to classify something. So, you know, if it's in their interest to classify it as something, cause it's going to, you know, penalize you more, then that's probably what they're going to do. So it probably is better to play safe than sorry. And have you seen like any good tax software to track this stuff, or different apps, or different, I know that was a question we had from the audience, is, and I did see that there was, I forgot the name of the tax software. I think it was like TaxBit or something like that. I'm not affiliated with them, but I think that there are some different software where you can plug different APIs into. And I didn't know if there's anything like on the top of your head of, hey, you know, I would recommend someone checks this out, or because it seems like it's an absolute nightmare right now for people, especially traders and day traders and all these other people.
Yeah, well, there's a couple things. A lot of the companies, if you're in an exchange, they are now producing basically what a spreadsheet, which can be used for your 8949, which is the form that you put the sale of the assets. And the ones that I've received for my clients on sales of their assets are very good. I can pretty much just dump it into the software, into my tax software, and check it, and it seems to be good. For clients who don't have that, I just tell them to keep a spreadsheet of when you bought it, how much you bought, and when you sold it. And most people who are in cryptocurrency are pretty computer savvy. So just opening up a spreadsheet and having the date that you buy it, how much you bought, which kind of currency it is, or which kind of coin it is, and the dollar value. And then you do the same thing every time you sell it. And then you have the information you need. One thing that we haven't talked about is LIFO, FIFO, or cost averaging. So that's first in, first out, last in, first out, or cost averaging, which is how you decide what your basis is. If I bought Bitcoin for $500 years ago and then $5,000 a couple years ago, and then I turn around and sell one of them today, which one did I sell? The first one, the last one, or do I average the two? And my recommendation is that everybody uses FIFO, first in, first out, so the first one. Not because the IRS has told us. The main reason I recommend this is because the IRS hasn't told us, but if they're going to tell us, they're probably going to tell us FIFO. And if they tell you FIFO and you've been using LIFO, it's an accounting change and you have to fill out all these other forms and it's a bit of a fiasco. Cost averaging to me is just trouble because you've got to track the cost averaging when you sell something and then buy it, and then you have to redo the average, and it's just very complicated. So I just tell people to do FIFO, first in, first out. It does mean that you may be paying more taxes earlier if the price is consistently going up. But so it's more of a tax burden for people who bought years and years ago than for people who bought recently because it's been so volatile.
Yeah, and if you do use LIFO and then the government decides, hey, this has to be FIFO, then it looks like Beth might never need her landscaping done ever again. If that people have to go back to the drawing board on that one. But you know, as we're wrapping up here, you know, I think you did mention different exchanges. If you got more than $10,000, and that triggers some sort of FinCEN regulations, is that also true with people who have, let's say, their money on Binance or they have their money on foreign exchanges? Do you know if there's any, and we didn't run by this, this is, you know, kind of shooting off the cuff here. Do you know if there's any certain amount, like, hey, if you got $10,000 and it's sitting on Binance, now you have to, I forgot the name of the form you've got to fill out for, but you know, what if you've got, you know, $50 sitting on Binance, is that going to be a problem, or do you know how that's treated?
So the form you're thinking of used to be called an FBAR, and
yes,
it's now called the FinCEN 114. And if you have more than $10,000 total in all your foreign accounts, and this is retirement, bank, investment, anything overseas, you have to complete this form. There's no tax. It's just a disclosure. Right now, FinCEN is saying, which is the organization as well as the name of the form, they're saying you don't have to complete the FBAR, FinCEN 114, if it's cryptocurrency, but I just tell clients do it. There's no tax penalty for doing it. It's just a disclosure. and it will protect you if anything changes. And it also sends the message that you're not trying to hide something. So then if the IRS says, hey, you know, why haven't you claimed any of this? You can say, you know, I haven't sold it, but look, I've admitted that I have it. So to some extent, it's a CYA. It's not a bad thing to do, and it doesn't really cost you anything. The thing I will say, though, that most people don't realize, and you were talking about even before cryptocurrency, even before Bitcoin, people were gambling over online, which was foreign accounts, because there's no U.S. gambling online. And people were collecting more than $10,000 in their little gambling accounts, in their online account. And that is subject to FBAR, which is why I tell people, especially now since some of the gambling sites use some of these cryptocurrencies, that I think it may end up being flagged soon to be part of FBAR. So just report it. Then it, like I said, doesn't hurt you in any way.
No, that's great information. I didn't realize it changed from FBAR to the FinCEN whatever form. It seemed like that was probably relatively new change. But, you know, as we're wrapping up here, just want to see, you know, you've mentioned earlier that you can work with people all around the country. What's the best way for people can find you? Do you have a website, or should they contact an email, or how would they, if they have questions after this? You know, I think you do work by the hour on this. So if you have a small question and want to have, you know, a little, use Beth as a consultant, would people be able to do that versus, you know, hey, I want to use Beth to completely do my taxes? And how can people best get a hold of you, and how would you prefer to work with people?
Well, I have clients actually all over the world, because there's people outside the United States who still have to pay U.S. taxes. So I have them around the world and all states. The nice thing about being an enrolled agent is we're federally licensed, so there's no issue with any state. You can reach me, you can find information on my website, which is kozlog.com, kozlog.com. You can write me at info@kozlog.com or taxes@kozlog.com. Either email works. And I do by the hour. I have Bitcoin clients who I do their tax return. I have one Bitcoin client who he comes in pretty much once a year, sits down, talks to me, makes sure he's doing everything right, and leaves. And he just pays for the time that he works with me. So it's whatever really works for the taxpayer. You mentioned this earlier, and it kind of goes with one of the things I say. Taxes and death are inevitable, so we teach neither. Sometimes people just need a little guidance, but like to be in control of their money, and that's perfectly fine with me. And some people say, I know nothing about it. It's yours. I don't want to deal with it. I don't do numbers. So whichever one works for the client works for me.
Okay, well, we really want to thank Beth for coming on the podcast today. This is incredibly valuable information. I mean, even I learned some stuff, and I'm a certified financial planner working in this space. So, you know, I'm sure, you know, a lot of people are going to have questions and are really thankful for this commentary, because really, you know, there's not really, you know, this is probably the only time you've really had like two, you know, a certified financial planner and an enrolled agent who specializes in this. Both, you know, our world's coming together, but with all the regulations of I'm not allowed to give tax advice, or on this platform, even investment advice, this is all for informational purposes. Everything's going to be, you know, dictated upon your own personal situation. So, you know, if you have questions, you know, about cryptocurrencies in general, you can get, you know, give myself a call, and we can also do some help with people who, you know, hey, if you don't want to deal with taxes, we can put some crypto into an IRA, a retirement account, and then you don't have to worry about the taxes. But if you're like most people and you don't have it in an IRA, it's going to be a problem. There's going to be headaches. If you want to run those questions by Beth, she charges by the hour, and we will have her info linked in the show notes. And thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. Would anybody want to buy Bitcoin inside their IRA? I mean, the whole point of Bitcoin was to have peer-to-peer electronic cash. So why are you going to have a financial intermediary buy Bitcoin for you? Why don't you just cash out your 401k, cash out your IRA, cash out your retirement plan, and just buy Bitcoin on your own? Well, the reason for that is if somebody had January 1st, 2017, invested $100,000 into Bitcoin, and then 1 year later, they would have had, after taxes and the 10% penalty,
they would have just under $900,000. So you would have turned $100,000 into close to $900,000. So you're obviously doing something right. However, there is a better way that they could have done it. What they could have done is they could have done a Roth conversion. With a Roth conversion, you save the 10% penalty, so you've got 10% more that could be invested into crypto. And the beauty of this is that now all of your gains are now forever tax-free. So you put the $100,000 in, and now, and again, you're getting out of paying the 10% penalty, and now in all my management fees, you now have a little over $1 million. We have all the exact specific numbers linked down or should be on the screen right now. I don't have it memorized, but you know, to me, you know, $1 million sounds a little bit better than $900,000, and having tax-free gains forever sounds better than having $900,000 that now any appreciation or hopeful potential appreciation would then be subject to tax. And the other reason why we thought of this, or really the genesis of this, is I had heard a lot of people doing this, and I thought that, hey, there's got to be a better way. But the main reason is you've got a lot of people who the only money they have to invest is inside of their retirement accounts. A lot of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. I mean, even people who have million-dollar IRAs, a lot of them don't have actual extra money to invest. They don't have rainy day funds. And the rainy day funds should be kept in actual safe, liquid, you know, basically cash or really short-term treasury bills. It shouldn't be invested into Bitcoin. And so a lot of people just don't have that extra money to invest. And so taking a small percentage of your IRA or 401k and then, you know, putting it into Bitcoin, if you know what you're doing and you understand the risk and you actually believe in this philosophically, is actually, I think, you know, a good move to make. So again, if you're going to pull money out of your 401k to buy Bitcoin, you should talk to myself, because I think that the Roth IRA conversion is a much better way of doing things. And that is why somebody would want to consider having Bitcoin inside their IRA as opposed to cashing out their 401k and just buying it outright.
Okay, well, that's great. You've got people who have IRAs and 401ks, and you know, there's different things you can do or that I can do to help them out. But what about the person that has maybe a few million dollars of gains and they bought it on Coinbase or Kraken, or they got several millions of dollars of gains and all of a sudden now you want to go buy your Lambo or buy a new house? I mean, there's no way you're going to be able to skirt around the IRS, because they're going to wonder, you know, hey, how'd you get that $500,000 to buy a new house? Well, for those people, probably the best person to explain this is actually my friend Ernest Hancock, as he was giving me an introduction at Anarchapoco. Anyways, I'll let Ernie take it away, because we can also have advanced trust strategies for the people that have millions of dollars of gains. This is not just for people who are looking to invest parts of their IRAs or 401ks.
A good friend of mine, Tim Pachote, he's a financial advisor at Scottsdale. He'll be speaking at the TDV event. To be able to bring the crypto into the system, how would you be able to do a foundation of trust, of this, of that, and so on? And well, Tim was at the party, and I go, Tim, what up? He's been spending months that he's getting ready to present to you guys Monday on how you can take your crypto and not pay capital gains on it, not have taxes on it. I'm going, man, you need to talk to Tim, okay?